Hello, everyone. Happy 10th anniversary to the movie Drive, which is the subject of today's prestige film. It came out in this week on 2011. It was directed by Danish filmmaker Nicholas Winding Refn.
Whoa.
Who also has directed some things I've seen before, that the crime biopic Bronson came out in 2008. He also did that Viking period piece action film Valhalla Rising in 2009 before Drive. It was written by Hossein Amini, who also wrote, got an Oscar for his work on The Wings of a Dove, also wrote the screenplay for 47 Ronin. Based on the novel Drive by James Salas, it stars Ryan Gosling, former Mouseketeer turned star of the romance The Notebook.
Yeah.
Also in Big Short, was just in Blade Runner not too long ago, the new one. Mm-hmm. Carey Mulligan, who also is in Pride and Prejudice, The Great Gatsby remake with Leonardo DiCaprio, Inside Llewyn Davis. Bryan Cranston, Bald Moo, fan favorite, Walter, motherfucking White,
yeah,
as the car man Shannon in this film. Albert Brooks, who I was today years old when I found out he was not actually another son of Mel Brooks. I was shocked.
Yeah, apparently he's not related. Brooks endemic in Hollywood, because there are a lot of Brooks.
Lots of Brooks in Hollywood. He was in Taxi Driver and Private Benjamin in the late 70s, early 80s, and then came all the way to 2011 to be menacing in a way I've never really seen before in this movie as a gangster, Bernie. Oscar Isaac. We know Oscar Isaac, right? Poe Dameron from Star Wars, amongst other things. Christina Hendricks, another Bald Move fan favorite. Who can forget Joan from Mad Men? And then Ron Perlman. We know Ron. Ron Perlman of Hellboy fame, of One of the Blade fames, of Pacific Rim fame. He of the Lantern Jaw. Jim, this is a very arty neo-noir gangster film set in L.A.
Yeah.
What did you think of it?
I remember coming away from this movie the first time remembering mostly the aesthetic, in that it is, yeah, a neo-noir film sort of draped in vaporwave, right? Like, and I don't know that comes through in the actual filming of it so much as it comes through in the key art and the soundtrack. Those are by far the most vaporwavy elements of this production. But that is the vibe I had coming out of it. It felt like, do you remember the game Hotline Miami? I feel like Hotline Miami bit a lot off of this movie's feel. And that was it. It was that, and it was the scene of Bryan Cranston's character getting it that I came away from this movie with, and that was seared into my head, that moment.
Yeah, the love scene between him and Mr. Brooks was just, he just gets it in the most unforgettable way.
Yeah.
yeah, I remember, because this happened at the dawn of Bald Move. I know we saw it, but I don't think we were actually talking about movies at the time. Like, we might have just started covering television. Maybe. And whatnot. And I was, you know, a big Bryan Cranston fan from Breaking Bad. And I was expecting a very slick, stylish action film. And what I got was a very slick and stylish art house film that left me very cold and nihilist feeling at the end of it. Mm-hmm. It has some of the most shocking violence I've ever seen, because it kind of comes out of, when it starts up in the movie, it kind of comes out of nowhere. And I just, I don't know, like, because this is very... I imagine this is films a lot of very influential, because I don't think you have John Wick or Fury Road if you don't have this film.
I don't feel like you have Ryan Gosling and Blade Runner if you don't have this film.
You're probably not wrong there. But for all those reasons, and this movie is well loved, it was well decorated, has a very high, you know, critic score, slightly lower. Well, not even slightly lower audience score, because I feel like a lot of people like me were expecting a more conventional action film, which has to do something to give you something to care about the protagonist. And I feel like this movie wasn't interested in any of that. It was just all about archetypes and style. And I admire this film a lot. It's got a great soundtrack. It looks amazing all the time. It's got sickening displays of human depravity.
Yeah.
But it just leaves me feeling cold. And like I said, I admire this film, but I don't necessarily like it.
I mean, the main character of this movie keeps everybody, including the audience, at a distance. I don't think you're meant to like, you are, there is enough of a character and enough insight into that character to feel something for him, and to sympathize with him in a lot of cases, but it's barely a sketch of a character. The sketch of the character mm-hmm. is this is a good guy at heart who does bad things. And
people who deserve it.
Right, right. Yeah, not to random citizens. He's not doing shit like that. But he's a good guy, and that's enough of a piece of a character to latch onto and say, okay, I'm willing to follow him through this journey. But you're right, at the end, I don't know where the end of this movie wants to leave us necessarily, other than where we started. And I don't know that that's like a super compelling arc, even if it is one that's fairly easy to follow.
I think the other problem is Carey Mulligan, who is the exact same, and yeah. there's very little reason to care. She is the MacGuffin in this movie designed to be cared for.
Yeah.
But I don't give a shit about her. In fact, I don't like her in any of the films I've seen her in. I like The Great Gatsby. She's easily the weakest part of the film. I don't like Inside Llewyn Davis. And I wonder how much of that is just because she is like a question mark. That's what when I see her face, it's just a giant fucking question mark. She looks like a brick in Super Mario Brothers that might give me a mushroom or a fire flower. I'm not really sure.
And this movie plays into that.
I don't want to tap it to find out.
Right? The movie plays into that. The movie, it's not encouraging us to get in real tight with these characters, because both of them are they're very similar characters. Neither of them cares to say much of anything throughout this entire movie. They're almost, they're held back by the tone of this movie and the aesthetic of this movie,
I think.
The whole narrative is, and I don't know that it's bad. It's just subdued because
it's all
of what they're trying to go for artistically.
Yeah, because this isn't like a long, dreary film. It's not like a 2.5-hour slog fest. It's very
not
tight
boring.
Because like it's not a minute longer than it needs to be to do mm-hmm. what it does. But it like it always goes for atmosphere and mood, where I guess I'd rather it to do something with the characters. And it's just,
right.
you know, like Ryan Gosling and Carey Mulligan, I don't feel like have any chemistry. And it's really important, since there's such thin character sketches, to do that. Which is crazy, because Ryan Gosling has fucking chemistry with everyone.
No, it's this character. I don't know that this character would have chemistry with anyone, right?
Maybe.
And especially
with
not
kid.
A character.
Like, I believe yeah. the relationship yeah. between Ryan Gosling and Benicio, uh-huh. I think is his name. But I don't buy it between him and Carey, because like I said, Ryan Gosling's a really charming guy. Like, you want to like him, even when he's like, but he comes alive when he's like dealing with the kid, and I kind of would like him to come alive when he's dealing with her too, but they're both playing this kind of like dreamy, sleepwalky kind of
yeah.
fantasy role in the beginning, and then it all goes fucko. But by that time, I don't care. Like,
and
the final fit, that's the biggest damning thing at the end, is something shocking happens, and I just didn't care. I was like, yeah. oh. And it was interesting, like, I mean, like I said, Gosling has chemistry with fucking Albert Brooks. Mm-hmm. He has tons of chemistry with Bryan Cranston, which isn't fucking surprising. But yeah, just the two leads don't work together. And I feel like that really holds the movie back. I'll even go one further. He has better chemistry with Oscar Isaac in this film. The
True.
Baby daddy that he's moving in on.
Yeah.
That shit's believable. He has actually pretty intense chemistry with Christina Hendricks. It's all very menacing and dangerous. But like, those are two actors playing off each other, like giving something and getting something. I don't know. Maybe all of Hollywood figured that out about Mulligan, because like, I feel like she was everywhere in the mid 2010s and she's kind of like nowhere now. But maybe I'm also kind of avoiding stuff with her in it.
Yeah, I don't know what I've seen her in. Her character's name in this is Irene. And I guess we should talk about Irene, because I think Irene is like worst character in some ways in this movie. There's a lot of information that Irene should be dishing out, but maybe it's because of the aesthetic of this film that doesn't have them saying mm-hmm. anything to each other at any point in this movie. They're mm-hmm. basically just mm-hmm. trading looks, or maybe it's down to like, maybe it's down to just them not like wanting to paint this character in a certain way. But she does not say some key things to Ryan Gosling's character, to Driver, because I think that's his name in this movie, that she probably needs to be saying as someone who has a baby daddy who's in prison and about to get out in a week, and she kind of knows
coming in from jail. Is that important? So does she know that? But the other thing is, you could turn that around to Ryan Gosling and be like, hey, maybe when you're talking about being a driver, you can talk about the heists that you do.
They're both withholding information that is very important to this budding relationship that they have. And I get sort of angry about that, but that's really the only downside or potential flaw in this movie that I see. Everything else is really well done.
Yeah. I watching this, because I wanted to give it another shot. I just recently saw Baby Driver again, and I revised my estimation of that film upwards quite a bit. In fact, I think it's damn near close to being a perfect film. They just they fell in love with John Hamm, and there's too much Hamm in the third act. There's way too much Hamm. Need to cut some of those servings of protein, and I don't know, put some vegetables in there or something, because it's just too much of a good thing, I think. Yeah, so I'm like, so in the early stages, I'm like, okay, this is really good stunt driving, and it feels real. And I went on to, read up a little bit on the film, and I understand why that is. And that was something the director was going for. But like, it's kind of like when you see, if you put yourself back in a mind frame of seeing The Bourne Identity for the first time, like that's kind of car race. That's kind of like a car chase you've not seen before. Mm-hmm. And this is like a car driver, he's got his code. He's got all this stuff. But I thought that introduced well. I really like Bryan Cranston. I like that stuff. It's like, in fact, but the movie just hits a brick wall when he meets Carrie Mulligan on an elevator with her child, and they're supposed to have a spark, and there is absolutely no spark. And then they follow up that with just inexplicable more and more, and they keep on the movie kind of sags. And then when he gets away and they're like running another heist, the movie gets another pulse, and there's like a lot of graphic violence. But then it's like, it always comes back to this Irene situation.
Like break down, give a synopsis of what the movie's about, because I want to talk about that opening scene in spoilery terms. Let's do that and then get over that spoiler.
Ryan Gosling is the driver. It's all we know him as, or the kid. He is a young stuntman / auto mechanic / car racer who does odd jobs involving stunt work and car restoration for Bryan Cranston's character, who runs a body shop or a racing shop, or I don't know, some kind of car mechanic thing in LA.
He's also a stunt producer, I think.
Yeah.
Director.
Guys that like gets the cars ready and has the guys ready to do the things they need to do. And they pay their bills by doing stunt work. And on the side, they do heists where, you've seen Jason Statham transporting things. Mm-hmm. It's that. You've seen Baby Driver. You need someplace. You got to be someplace really quick, and you can't have cops or people with guns stopping and asking questions about it. You hire this guy.
And he only drives. He doesn't participate in the heists. He's just the getaway driver.
He doesn't carry a gun. Like you got him for 5 minutes. Anything before that or after that, he don't give a shit about. And he's not going to help. And everything's going swimmingly. In fact, it seemed like they might be going legit. They do a deal with a Los Angeles businessman that is going to get them into funding for a race team, and they want to go all in this like amateur NASCAR racing. Everything starts going bad when Carrie Mulligan walks in with her very cute son of a dad who's in jail and is going to get home soon. And guess what? He got out of jail, but the life of crime keeps pulling him back, and it puts the driver in a situation where is he going to let this young family that he cares about inexplicably get slaughtered by the underworld of LA, or is he going to fucking drive their way out of it? You'll never guess what course of action he chooses. And there's twists and turns from there. Some of them were pretty shocking.
I think
that's the premise of the film.
The gangster plot in this movie is real good, but we'll talk about it. I want to talk about the driving in this movie, because it's ostensibly mostly about that.
It's called Drive. It's a statement.
it's great. It's great in a way, like you said, it's different. Like The Bourne Identity was different like Italian Job, I guess, was different after Bourne Identity did it. The way the tactical nature of the driving really paints a picture of this character. And I love how they do that, because not a lot of driving movies will do that. Use the driving to tell you something about the main character. He's smart. Is like number one. He's very controlled, constant poise. Like, he is the epitome of cool, right? In these high pressure situations. And that first driving scene does a hell of a lot of heavy lifting to tell you about this character. Mm-hmm. And it's exciting, I think, too, the way he's dodging. And I've never quite seen it. It's not a high speed chase for the most part, right? It's a game of cat and mouse. And I really love that part of it.
They also show that he's not afraid to go directly at things, too. Like, he's a very direct character. And I feel like some of the stunt work tells that part of the story, too. Mm-hmm. I saw that, like, the actor or the director had a couple things. That first car sequence is essentially, I guess, Ryan Gosling went through a stuntman school so he could do some of his own stunts.
Okay.
And it was just him and the director with a handheld camera inside the car for like 2 days. And he never wanted the action to leave the car and go from an exterior. Like, it's all either going to be tight work on the car so you can see what it's doing, and inside reaction. That's like the world that he wanted to. And I think part of this works because it's a little amateur. Like, you know, you've got there's two things they did, what they called the biscuit rig, which was pioneered on the show, the movie Seabiscuit, which allows someone to be doing something and the actual person is to the side or behind. So Ryan Gosling can just essentially act like he's driving and concentrate on his performance, and a stuntman's doing the heavy lifting behind him or to the side, and the camera doesn't pick any of that stuff up. But I think a lot of it is like one of the other car sequences involving Christina Hendricks works because I think you have a terrified actor in the back seat of the car getting thrown around, and you're just organically. Like, it, there's something kind of real to, like, you know, her horrified look as she's like going back and forth, and there's a car spiraling in the back seat, flipping end over end behind her. It's, you know, these are like, the driver is completely unflappable, but all this chaos swirling around, and this, it doesn't look pretty. There's not near misses. Cars are getting clipped all the time. There's something to it. There's something very direct and unpretentious about the car driving action. That is completely missing from a Fast and Furious, for example.
And I like also how Gosling's reaction to the situations he's in when he's in the car changes over the course of the movie a little bit. Like, he's still very poised and calm and collected and all that. But in the beginning, he's much more so, right? There's a marked difference between his expression when he's driving these two guys who pull off this heist, whatever, at the beginning, versus when he's got Christina Hendricks in the car. He's a little more panicked. You can tell still with it. But yeah, there is an evolution of that character throughout the film through the driving. And I think it's probably the best part of the movie. Yeah, I don't know. The gangster part's very good as well. I want to talk about that. But yeah, I love the driving.
I think, like I said, that's the stuff I like about the movie. The driving, the gangster stuff, the like ultra violence, even, I don't have a problem with. It's just everything about the. Everything they use to like build the emotional stakes, by and large, doesn't work for me. Honestly, I kind of like the. I got a lot of juice out of Bernie.
Yeah.
Like, this guy that's capable of doing this shocking stuff, but he doesn't want to. Like, he doesn't really, like, he's really pissed at Ron Perlman for putting him in this position.
Yeah.
But there's something just like cold and clinical. I don't want to talk too much about that yet, because I want to spend the whole conversation on that. The way they do storytelling with the driver, because he has very little dialogue, he almost never says anything, but they do really cool stuff. Like, he's always pictured driving, and they've got like this one shot where it's like the camera is the stick shift and it's looking up at him, and he's driving through these sequences of like probably overpasses, and like there's this whole shadow rolls over his body. But then you also, his eyes are lit by the rear view mirror. It gives him kind of like, he looks like he's wearing a baklava, and you just see his eyes. And then his whole face lights up and he goes to another tunnel. The sequence of this, like, as kind of reflecting the like hopeful and dark thoughts that are kind of rolling through his mind. Some slick shots like that really, again, because you don't know anything else about what's going on. This guy's like, you have to have things like that. And this movie delivers them in spades, I think.
Yeah, what about the driver's look? And throughout the movie, he's got this scorpion jacket that he wears, this white jacket with a gold scorpion emblazoned on the back. I feel like for a guy who steals cars to be not very noticeable and is worried about like, oh, is this Impala going to get me noticed? It's no, it's gray and it's the most common car in right. LA, so you'll be fine. No one will even look at you. To wear mm-hmm. a fucking iconic jacket like this is yeah, a little out of character.
High vis white. Although I guess like if he's in the ditch car phase where he takes that thing off and puts on like a Dodgers cap, mm-hmm. It becomes like even better camouflage because you're looking for this. We're going to find this guy with like a jacket that's brighter than the sun. It's got a gold scorpion on the back.
Yeah.
Look at this Joe Job just walking down in a drab jeans and a Dodgers cap. Can't be him. And they just run right past him.
But then when you're sitting in the diner and like one of the guys who you drove previously recognizes your giant scorpion. Yeah, you're
sure
probably not as camo as you want to be. So yeah, I don't know. I guess it's a double-edged sword. But yeah, it is like pretty iconic. I like the look.
And they're very smart. They show him like, you know, doing this, which this has now become kind of tropey, the like just park a car somewhere and melt away. Like I think the first time I ever saw that mm-hmm. was in a Patriot Games movie.
Oh,
where
wow.
It's like the idea that you can like just park in a big parking lot in a mall and they're looking for your aerial and you just walk into a mall and you might as well walked into a fucking alternate reality because what the fuck?
Yeah.
You know, you can just take your, you just shed your outer clothes, buy some. It's
are we getting to the point where that's not going to be a thing in movies because of facial recognition?
Yeah, I already think we're there. Traffic I was games. Actually like, the more I'm like, I'm watching Sopranos, mm-hmm. Sopranos would be rolled up like with the amount of bodies that they drop. Like there's so many cameras and CCTVs yeah. and stuff. I feel like if the thing is like pissing off the police bad enough that they want to do this because it's actually hard police work going around. All right. Crime happened here. Where's the camera? Where's the camera? They went this way. What are the street cameras? You have to build like a whole but yeah, you can if you cared enough to. It's just
yeah.
Yeah. And usually murders are the things that really arise to that kind of level of scrutiny.
I feel like now they're just going to have like the cops up in the helicopter are just going to have an app where they can hit a button and just like, you know, drawing lines on a football field in real time or text on a football field on television. They can just pinpoint you and watch you walk down the street.
Yeah, that's going to be like once like and if they get a engine sophisticated enough, they'll hand off between cameras. It's like, hey, this is the person of interest. And
have this mesh network of facially identifying camera. Yeah, it'll be so easy.
I mean, on the one hand, it seems like a great crime fighting tool for like murders and rapes and stuff. But on the other hand, pretty Orwellian. We'll see if it's used for good or evil. I don't know. I will say there's two scenes that used to work a lot better until like 3 months ago. Every time he puts on that foam face, I can't think of anything other than I think you should leave skit where the guy's like, I got too much shit on me. This chin kills.
I'm taking the head off.
I'm taking the head off. The bit's going to be like, I'm taking this shit off. It's so fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
And it just destroys the climax of the end of this movie.
It was pretty silly looking.
Yeah.
But I think you're right.
That just really underlines it. The fact that like, we got Ryan Gosling's dead doll eyes looking from the depths of this faux mask. It's oh my. And then, you know, if you haven't seen a Netflix series, then I guess and Drive is your favorite movie. Don't because it'll wreck it. It'll wreck it the full third of this movie.
Feel like it makes the whole final, that whole beach scene a lot creepier, though, like stalking
it's
him
very Michael
into
Meyer,
the ocean.
Yeah,
it's very creepy. I liked that part of it, but you're right.
I think that's all. Silly. That's the thing. It's like sometimes the intentionalities art films get me. And I just this came up a lot in Pig where it's like, boy, this is like film house. This is film school 101 and he's doing it. Like I was reading that, like, he wanted you to understand that, like, Ryan Gosling is kind of like he used the word werewolf in this interview several times.
Sure.
Like he's a man, but he can turn into an animal. And like when, his girlfriend sees him kick that guy's head in the elevator,
mm-hmm.
like that's her like witnessing her lover turn into a werewolf. And I think that like the latex mask is directly supposed to remind you of something like Michael Meyer. This implacable, unkillable monster, something monstrous that he's transformed himself into. but he can still go back to being a man. Like, you know, it's mm-hmm. it's a transformation. It's not like who he is underneath or like who he is at his core. It's something he literally transforms into, which is kind of cool. But like I said, it's something that like really textual. So it's very noticeable.
Yeah. And I mean, the symbolism does come through. Certainly it's part of my notes here. So.
And that's interesting because like they even bring this up in the movie where Gosling is watching a movie with her kid or a series or something. He's like, oh, is that a bad guy? And he's like, yeah, how can you tell? He's like a shark. Oh, there's no good sharks. No, you can tell. Just look at him. You know, like Ryan mm-hmm. Gosling at this stage in his career, I think most people look at him and he's the, you know, he's the tearjerker guy in Notebook. He's not like a menacing, dangerous guy. So like, I think they're showing the difference between like the true bad guys, but it's funny is cause like this film is filled with people who, you know, like if you look at Ron Perlman versus Albert Brooks, like who is the threatening figure?
Ron Perlman. Yeah.
But he's the joke. Like he's uh-huh. like, if it weren't for Bernie, he would have probably been fish food a long time ago. And the kind guy is the one that you really are scared of. They play that theme a lot. Monsters versus the truly dangerous people in the world.
Yeah, and I think casting against type with Ryan Gosling was a smart move in that regard, because it, as little as they sell the chemistry and the romance between him and Irene in this movie, can you imagine if it was Ron Perlman in that role as driver? Like I mean maybe they would have had more chemistry, I don't know, but you would have looked at him immediately and said, oh, that's a bad guy, you shouldn't get involved with him. Whereas Ryan Gosling, you don't know.
In early goings, you think that the Gosling might be a Baby Driver type who is just like, he's just uncomfortable with violence. And but there's that great scene in the diner where a guy who you understand maybe one of his drives broke bad for tries to recruit him on the side. And he's like, you shut your fucking mouth or I'll kick every teeth down your throat. Just out of nowhere, this mm-hmm. side and like, fuck, Gosling. Okay. Just a little hint before we actually see him do stuff like that. They're like, nah, this isn't some naive guy that was manipulated into. He's done already at this stage a lot of bad stuff and doesn't mind doing more if he thinks you deserve it.
For sure. There's something you said to go back to the driving very quickly here. It's something you said about the technique that they use to get these shots where they have, what was it, the biscuit cam?
The biscuit rig. The
biscuit rig, where you got a different guy driving. They use that in this movie, and it's very obvious now that you've pointed it out, because there's one scene where he's driving into his parking garage at his apartment building, and Oscar Isaac has just been beat up, and the two guys who did it are walking out of the parking garage, and Ryan Gosling eyes them at the same and never takes his eyes off of them even for a split second. And as he's watching them, he's parking his car in a very tight space. So you can tell that like so that must be the biscuit rig, right? Because the stuntman is the one who's actually driving the car. But also in the movie, it's really effective in showing you just how instinctual of a driver he is, because he doesn't even need to look where he's going. He can feel it. Yeah, and it's a really good touch.
That's a good point, because I didn't even notice that. But I noticed it subconsciously because I saw how intensely he's looking. But the fact that he's doing a complicated park is without checking his mirrors or anything.
Nothing.
Very impressive. Yeah.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club?
Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our Premium Club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
I feel like that sometimes a movie sweats details like that, but there was a couple things that I bothered me, like they're doing the one last heist to clear what is his name, is this guy's name Standard, which I thought funny, Standard Gabriel, and I forgot the obvious joke, where's the deluxe version,
it's pretty good,
but Standard gets this thing goes all pear-shaped when he tries to rob this pawn shop and he gets shot. But I don't know how we go from like that shot of like Gosling peeling out of there and laying tracks and these guys chasing him on foot to like we smash cut to like a exciting chase between him and some belligerent down the freeway. And I think they later fill in that like there was a second car and there was some stuff that we didn't know about. But like it left me very disoriented. But maybe I guess that's what the director was trying to do. Like, well, Ryan Gosling didn't know about the second chase car. But I would have liked a scene like, I think there's a cut missing there where like he tears past the SUV who's parked in another lot and it tears at. Because I was like, well, how the fuck did they chase up with them or catch up with them? They're nowhere near a car. Ryan Gosling is driving like a bat out of hell. He's the best driver in this film.
Yeah.
And then like 2 seconds later, there's on his ass.
No,
and
there's a second car in that parking lot.
I felt
they
did a bad storytelling job. Was there?
Yeah, they tell it. There's a second car in that parking lot with him.
And then it doesn't follow him out of that scene, does it?
Yeah, totally.
Huh. Okay, well, maybe I just fucked up. And
at least that's how I thought.
I thought there was a bad edit where there felt like there's a couple connecting scenes that should have been there, and it just didn't quite work.
Hmm. No, I got it. I guess I'm not entirely sure whose second car was in that parking lot. So it's Ron Perlman's car, or it's the New York gangster's car?
It's part of the setup, and you find that out later, and that's fine because like, okay, well, we shouldn't have any information driver doesn't have.
So
I'm just saying that like in the moment I wish we saw that develop, like, you know, as he pulls out of a parking lot, another car shifts into gear and peels out after him, or so a car like peeling out of a side drive or something. So because otherwise,
we do see it. Is Ron, okay. So Ron Perlman's idea there is he's hiring this low-level gangster dude in the tracksuit to hire Oscar Isaac, to force Oscar Isaac and Christina Hendricks to go rob this $1 million from the pawn shop that belongs to the East Coast Mafia, and then he's going to rip them off, making it look
And then he'll be insulated from it because they won't be like, oh, this well-known Jewish Italian mobster ripped us off. It's this no-name what's his face and his red-headed sister. And maybe they face consequences, or maybe they just wind up dead before the East Coast guys ask me questions. But the thing is, I didn't spend a lot of mental energy trying to figure it out because Brooks lets me know later on that's a meathead play and a meathead plan. That was doomed to fail like it did, you know, like okay, it's a great idea to hire a bunch of no name low lifes off the street to take the fall. But guess what? You're trusting no name low lifes on the street to fucking do the job for you in the first place. So yeah, congratulations.
True. OK, that tracks.
What do you think of Christine Hendricks, by the way?
She's different than I've seen her in anything else. I guess maybe I'm focusing too much on the Mad Men, Firefly, Christina Hendricks, but I've never seen her in like modern day street clothes of just like normal everyday, like a hoodie and a t-shirt. And it was kind of weird, but I liked it.
She's great, but it's also odd to see her in a role that gives her almost zero agency. She's like bullied and browbeat in this situation. She's literally bullied and beat by the driver to get information out of her. She then gets like the first truly shocking piece of violence in the film is her head getting obliterated in slow motion by a shotgun. I don't know why Hollywood, I mean, maybe it's her own choice. Like, she fucking did Mad Men. She did two of the most memorable performances in Firefly. And then she did, you know, Drive. And she's got like, you know, Oscar nominations. She's got Emmy nominations. She's got sci-fi pulp clout. And she's like, you know what? Fuck it. I can be choosy. But like, I can think she was in that. What was that other Michael K. Williams thing? Leroy and the Bird, or Frank and McCastle. And
I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't seen her in a lot of stuff post Mad Men. I'm like, is Hollywood just not know what to do with her? It's sad because I think she's great and I just hardly have ever seen her in anything.
Yeah, same here. Haven't seen her in a lot of modern stuff. What do you think of Bryan Cranston in this movie? Speaking of some of the actors.
He's great, man. He does exactly what he needs to do. He plays this like crusty put upon guy who's like just trying to hustle for money at the lower rungs of Hollywood. And you know, he's like charming and he knows like who's like. He knows he's got to like butter up Ron Perlman, but he knows that, you know, Brooks is the real power behind the throne. And I remembered. Here's the thing. I remember that death scene going on a lot longer. I thought we stayed on him until Cranston dies. Maybe it's just because that's just how fucking vivid it is, because there's something about like him. It's like a veterinarian that's putting a dog to sleep. Chilling in the same way that like that Nazi stabbing the kid, the machine gunner in the end of Saving Private Ryan. Like the you know, he's being so gentle and like, shh, it's over. It's just easy. Like, you're just going to die now and it's OK. There's something about that that's so like that is way more psychopathic than like a guy chopping you up with a chainsaw to me. You know,
it's very strange. It's not
the empathy and bedside manner. I know, like, you know, and then all but I think it's merciful. Make them feel better about it.
It's I mean, like he's right about it. Right. When he says, look, it's done. It's over. Like,
that's the hard part.
You know,
no pain.
And he's just cut his entire arm, not just his wrist, but the way down forearm. He's done. There's nothing that can be done about this. It's over, like he says. And there's something merciful about doing it that way, right? Because there is no pain. It's not torture. It's just like this is a matter of fact thing that he's got to do, and it's done. You know, it's weird. And you contrast that with the gore that's coming out of his arm, right? The pools of blood that are just flowing. And there's something very unsettling about that scene. And it's the one scene that absolutely stuck with me from this movie. For the 10 years it's been since I've seen it.
It's so different from gangland assassinations. Like, you think you compare him to like, Sam L. Jackson's character from Pulp Fiction. So, you know, my name's Pitt. And you're not talking your ass out of it. Like, just blatant intimidation from the get go.
Yeah.
Whereas this is it's the velvet glove killer. It's Rick and Morty made this point that like just sudden death out of nowhere is far more terrifying than something you can kind of like see coming. That's the thing that the deaths that shock me are like when like a gangster will just come up to someone and tap him in the head. Like the idea that like you're living your life and then it's lights out and you don't even fucking know it. You're just life just is over and how fragile it is. Like, you know, you're shaking guy's hand and now you're fucking going to bleed out in 30 seconds. It's fucking, I don't know. It fucks with me.
But that's the way to do
it. Plays it. So like he plays it exactly like a guy in that where he thought he talked himself out. He's crossing the rainbow. He's going to cross a rainbow bridge. He's crossing the bridge and he thought he's going to lose his life. Now he's gained his life and now it's over. Mm-hmm. And that reversal has happened in like 15 seconds.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
That's wild. That's a great scene.
It also is like, I really like the scene between Gosling and Brooks. Like, again, fucking Gosling has chemistry with everyone in this movie except for the person he's supposed to. But there's this, like, they're both smiling each other, and it's kind of like the same smile, like when a child comes up and tells you something that's very naive, but like, you know, like, oh, dad, I hope we're always together. And you smile like, well, you know, you don't, what are you going to do? Tell a 3-year-old, well, I'm going to die one of these days. Hopefully, you know, a lot. But it's kind of like there's this kind of like smile, like when, you know, he's looking at the driver and the driver thinks he's negotiated this stuff and he's about to betray it. But like Gosling's smiling back in the exact same way, because he knows that this guy is going to try to fuck him and he's going to fuck him back. And there's something that really works well, that conversation where they're both looking at each other with these wolfish grins and only one of them actually knows what the fuck is going on. And it's not the guy you expect. I thought that worked really well.
Yeah. The big question mark I have is, why doesn't he do the same move to Gosling that he did to Cranston, right? Where he cuts his whole arm open. Instead, he just stabs him sort of in the gut area and gives Driver an opportunity to kill him instead, which is exactly what happens. So
yeah, I don't know, because there's something there again, there's just like an impressionist kind of rule of cool to this movie. And where Brooks, after he kills Cranston, he uses that like straight razor and he cleans it up, he puts it in a case. And like in my mind, that suggests that he selects a knife for each person. He's, first of all, he kills a lot of people. These are the knives he uses to do it. And he picked a different knife that, and I don't know, maybe it's because, I don't know why, because I don't think the movie does either. It's just they suggest that this is some kind of thing.
Go for something that's a killing blow, not a gut wound.
Yeah. Although I don't think that anything would this guy's a much older, you know, I think Ryan Gosling can kick his ass. Like the deal is he just thought he was dealing with the lamb.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he hadn't seen the lion yet, and he kicked this tiger in his ass, had no plan to deal with his teeth and claws, and that's like, I don't know what you do short of like decapitation. Like if you meat cleaver or the chef knife his neck 3 times, it would have done him in. But I don't know what Albert Brooks does to this guy that takes him out, that he can't just get a knife right in him. So
yeah, he was unprepared for that.
While the movie in 2011, it comes out where the knife violence is way, way more disturbing and horrific than the gun violence.
Yeah.
And again, the gun violence includes someone's head getting misted by a shotgun.
Right. No, I couldn't tell you exactly why that knife scene with Cranston is so visceral and sticks with me, whereas I totally forgot about the shotgun scene with Christina Hendricks. Didn't do it, but yeah.
You know, I think another thing that gives this the vaporwave kind of aesthetic, even though it doesn't earn it, is the soundtrack.
For sure.
It's very synth heavy. That Real Hero, Night Call, that shit is the beat. Like, it's the beating heart of this movie. And like I said, I guess you call me a hater of this movie. I'm not really a hater. I guess I'm a cold admirer of this cold, bloodless movie. But like, the soundtrack almost gets me all the way on the board of just being, all right, this fucking works for me.
Yeah.
I think you take any other replacement actor and you slaughter into Carey Mulligan's role, and this movie just works for me. If you just anybody that like I bought that on site, you would just like, or they, I don't know, like you could have Gosling needs a backstory where his mom was a single mom that raised something that like, it makes me think that like he identified and could see himself as like this missing puzzle piece and this thing right away. And they don't really do that. In fact, like, this is crazy. Like the movie sets up more chemistry between Oscar Isaac and Carey Mulligan than it does with Gosling here. Like when he's at the little coming home party and he's telling the meet cute about, you know, like, oh, I said my name is Standard. And she's like, what's the I like that. And she's got this like kind of like slow smile as he's telling the story. Like, I didn't feel any of that stuff with the Gosling.
I got a suggestion for you. You just swap Carey Mulligan and Christina Hendricks in this movie. And I think that relationship is twice as good.
Interesting. I guess I'd have to see that because, like, again, Christine Hendricks wasn't giving me that. But yeah, I mean, I've seen her have chemistry with a lot of different people.
Yeah. But then if they make her just make googly eyes and smile sheepishly at him, it's not going to do much for him. So, like, yeah, I think you needed some lines from the characters.
Well, so there's another big question mark I had about that scene where they're driving the L.A. River. And I'm like, OK, well, this is just like, well, he's a stunt driver and he's doing the grease shit. And oh, this is where they filmed T2. But then they drive to Narnia and I'm like, does the actual L.A. River end in a nature sanctuary that's just like beautiful and pristine and unpolluted? And like maybe it does. But
I know that thing expands hundreds of miles. Certainly
it has to. It has to. And
they're not it's not short enough that he could drive it in one day, I don't think, like back and forth.
But I don't know. To the end of the concrete tunnel and it just turns into a nature preserve. I don't know. But it felt like a fairy tale. And I even put that in my notes, is like, this seems like a fairy tale sequence. Mm-hmm. And then I read in an interview where he had the idea to make this movie after he'd read Grimm's fairy tales. And he was actually looking to make kind of like a modern fable with L.A., kind of like this dark forest and that these characters inhabit and all that stuff. And I'm like, OK,
I didn't get any of that.
I guess I see that a little bit.
Boy, he'd really have to handhold me through this movie, telling me like, see here, this building here, this is a big tree. And
well, I can see, because like he did. There's also
Ron
the way
Perlman's
he filmed
the big bad wolf.
I mean, obviously, this thing is set in 2010 L.A., but like aesthetically, it's like all the cars and the, well, without except, I mean, the late model Chevy Impala is a late model Chevy Impala. But with the cars and the clothing and the musical cues are suggesting the 80s. And he also, the way he filmed L.A., like there's a lot of new modern millennial architecture in L.A. downtown, to put it mildly. But they never show that. All the locations they picked were supposed to be like kind of old school, more classically run down L.A. And the only time you see that stuff is at a distance. Like there's a couple of nighttime helicopter shots that I thought made L.A. look like Blade Runner version of L.A. So I kind of got the dark forest aesthetic that, you know, decent people can get lost in, you know, witches popping up here and there, giants and werewolves and monsters and stuff. I kind of get a little bit. I see where he's going.
Why does he get lost? I wish I knew more about the character driver, because he's pretty much an enigma throughout this entire movie. We don't understand why he came to L.A. looking for work in Shannon's garage. We maybe understand that, although I can't tell if Shannon is joking with
I don't even know that's a real backstory to him,
right? When he comes to the garage and he says, I paid him half what I pay my normal workers, don't tell him I've been taking advantage of him the whole time. Some of that element is true because he's like got him mixed up in all these schemes, right? But I don't know if he was mixed up in criminal schemes before he came to LA, and maybe that's why he came to LA, or where he's headed at the end of this. He's an enigma the entire time.
It also tracks like what the build on your point with Cranston, when Brooks is telling us his relationship with him, he says, like, yeah, like this guy used to charge twice as much.
Yeah.
He used to overcharge me all the time, but I didn't care because I liked him. And then he tried that shit with Nico and Nico broke his pelvis. So it's in this guy's character that he does kind of take advantage of the margins. And even when there's this, like, he's got this fast talking, I said, OK, kid, they want you to roll the car. And I got double your rate. Of course, we'll split that 50-50. It's like, what the fuck? You get to take half of the danger money because you negotiated it for me? What?
And he's also getting squeezed from the stunt side, right? There's a couple lines in there about how Hollywood, like, wants to skip out on the bills for a stunt
like
that they don't put in the movie.
Yeah, you spend 6 months building a stunt car, and then they blow it up in a day of shooting, and it gets cut in edit the first week of editing. And then probably they want to stiff you, I imagine.
Right. So there's, like, you can feel the squeeze from all sides in this, and he's doing it. He's perpetuating that, doing it to other people. It's confusing, but like but driver seems like strangely outside of it all. I don't know where he intersects with life, honestly.
Yeah, there's a lot of where I felt like the stylishness of the film, because like when he's in that one scene where he's threatening to beat the guy to death with a hammer, his like whole body is convulsing and shaking with the, I guess you're supposed to understand the fury that's coursing through his veins. Uh-huh. But like, it's such a grounded performance until then that it felt like, and again, I think maybe he's trying to he's like trying to sell this physical transformation into a monster. Like, mm-hmm. you know, like, this isn't how he's with Carrie. This isn't with how he's like with Benicio. But some of it was so outlandish that I'm like, okay, who is this guy? Like, is this guy a cool customer whose pulse doesn't raise in the most dangerous situation? Or is he the guy that has a flight or fight response so strong that he can't have a conversation when he's mm-hmm. angry or charged with violence where his whole body's not shaking? Like, that's two completely different characterizations you're trying to draw here. It's like a Brad Pitt in Ad Astra, you know, halfway through the movie yeah. has a scene where he's shaking with rage and he's froth. It's like, what the fuck? Like, I don't know. Like, it felt very, it was in there because it was cool and it was part of the story that he's wanting to tell, but it also undermined the characterization, but he didn't care because the stylishness is what was important for the film. And maybe that's the good instinct. Cause again, the film's got 95% on Rotten Tomatoes, won Oscars. Like I'm definitely in the minority, not getting this film on an emotional level.
Yeah, I do wonder, though, do you think this is the first time that he's been involved in something that has either gone
this
awry
fucked up?
Or, yeah, is even approaching this fucked
100%.
Up? 100%. Do his jobs usually go off perfectly smooth?
I think, well, if they're not smooth, it doesn't affect him. Because obviously okay, that one driver yeah. like intimates that like they had a drive go terribly, or that one guy had a, he meets in a cafe and he threatens, like I got from that they had a drive that went disastrously bad. But like it didn't fuck with Ryan, you know, it didn't fuck with Gosling's.
I thought they hired somebody else to drive them and it went disastrously bad and got them his buddy thrown in jail or whatever.
Okay.
And so
maybe.
He's trying to hire him back.
I see. Because we should have used you. It's kind of we used the second rated highest guy off Craigslist. And just maybe.
I think so.
I feel like I misinterpreted a couple of key scenes here.
Oh, maybe.
It's the second one I didn't feel like I had a good handle on.
I might have misinterpreted it, though. Who knows? You said it won awards. It was nominated for an Academy Award. It did win some awards, but no Academy Awards.
I thought
awards.
It won best, or like, I thought it did win some Academy Awards.
I'm just seeing best sound editing. It was nominated, and I don't believe it won. I'm not sure what it was up against. Let me see. Hugo took it that year, apparently, for best sound editing.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't a joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for podcasts that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
There are like a few other smaller things that I wanted to talk about. First of all, I thought I spotted a Breaking Bad reference in here when Bryan Cranston's talking to Bernie and he's like, where'd Driver go? He's like, he talked about running off to some country. It might have been Belize, which I think that's a Breaking Bad reference.
It could be, yeah. Mexico or Belize. Yeah, like that's, there's a lot of, I remember Belize was a...
As a Saul thing.
Yeah, like that's, but also I think Belize might just be like where you go. They've got non-extradition because that was also a plot in Justified, like the one corrupt, crooked dentist one that retired to Belize. And
that's why I'm not sure, but Cranston like, yeah, says Mexico, it with kind of a
Cranston
knowing.
Talking about, yeah, a guy fleeing to Mexico or Belize. If he said Alaska, because I don't think Breaking Bad wasn't finished enough, but if he said that, had been the trifecta.
Right, right. Another thing, during this car chase, the final car chase, where they're in the mountain passes, right? And they're trying to ram him off the road after the heist. Mm-hmm. He does this maneuver where he spins the car around and he's in what I presume was a rear wheel drive Mustang at the time. And he just kind of spins it around, goes in reverse and then spins it back around and causes them to crash. I did not understand the dynamics of that chase at all. I didn't know why spinning the car around helped him in any way. It has to do something with the handling, maybe. I really don't know.
Yeah, there's I don't know that you're talking about the one where he's doing the Rockford essentially transition from front. I don't know. Like, is that like just required? You have to put that into a car chase movie.
I suppose
like you got to have somebody flipping from reverse to the forward. Because I can't think of a single car chase that doesn't feature it.
Right. Yeah, you might be right. It didn't seem to give him a tactical advantage. I don't know why he did it, but whatever. And then I guess the last thing, I was thinking about movie stunts and how they're performed nowadays. And a lot of it is CG, but there's still a lot of, you know, traditional stunt work done. Now, my question is, I've seen Mythbusters. I've seen Grant Imahara rig up a whole bunch of like, is it what amounts to vehicular drones? For cars and trucks and all sorts of things. Do we need stunt drivers anymore? Or can we just have essentially a virtual biscuit rig? Yeah, a remote biscuit rig and just do this shit without people in the car. Put the dummy in the car and just remote control it.
I don't know like how much of that, especially because like this level of driving, if you're talking about just, you know, driving two people talking to each other in a car, having a conversation.
Oh, sure.
But like, yeah, when you're talking about like, I don't know, like how
risking
much of,
your life on this.
Yeah, but like you're gonna have actors in the car, right? Or are you talking about like
specifically virtual? These stunt crashes? Like, I don't know why you would put a human being in a car nowadays if your intention was to crash the car.
You're right. I mean, like self-driving cars are not the same thing as self-stunting cars, but like the only thing I can think of is like if you're talking about a remote control, then like you don't feel the tires brake traction, so you know when to begin to like, you know, counter steer and things like that, and you can't feel like the g-forces and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But if you actually had a AI driving it where it's like, hey, I need you up on two wheels, like the AI, a computer could probably keep a car on two wheels for as long as you need it to at whatever speed you want it to, you know, because it can just make so many more. But like if it's just remote control, probably you want it in the car. If it's AI and you're just like programming it to do things.
Like I've seen people who can do very impressive stuff with RC. RC quadcopters and
this is true.
All kinds of things. I don't know that it would be impossible. It might be harder. I agree. Like being in the car is probably, you get that feel. So you can get it up on,
I think that's what the stunt drivers union says. Hey, if you're not right. in the car, you don't have the feel. I gotta feel the steering wheel tremble, man. I gotta feel the rubber braking traction, man.
Probably say, oh yeah, on average,
the brake fade.
They've got a study. On average, it takes a remote driver, 25 takes to get a shot. I can do it. I've always done it in two. Like,
it's true. It's true. By the time you get the servos reset, I'm already strapped into the 5-point and I'm ready to go.
Right. I'm strapped into the new car. What, you want to waste 25 Impalas? I can get you there in two Impalas.
Exactly. Which means we're probably 20 years away rather than 5 years away from it happening.
Yeah. But that's about all I have to say about Drive. I still like this movie, even though I think you're right. It's mostly its feel, its look and feel that does it for me, as opposed to like substance.
But like I said, this movie is huge. Even if I don't like it for what it is, it's hugely influential. Because again, I don't think we have John Wick. I don't think we have Fury Road.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly don't have Baby Driver without this movie. Like, this movie says there is an appetite for a slick, stylish action thriller that's low on characterization and plotting, and it just is like straight to the fucking point. 90 minutes, like maybe this is 97 minutes. It's not a long film. And like I said, it's hugely influential in terms of style. This was a big part of, the vaporwave renaissance.
Yes.
It's undeniable the influence it had, even though I don't necessarily like it. But, you can say the same thing about the first Star Wars. Like, look at the stilted dialogue. The characters are thin. It's just special effects and style. Well, fuck, but look at the influence it's had. So it's 10 years on. It still leaves me cold. It still doesn't get its hooks in me like I can tell it gets into a lot of people. But I definitely respect what it's doing. Even if it's not my taste, I do respect what it's doing. I think it's mostly successful at trying to do those things. It's mm-hmm. just, for me, the lead chemistry is this movie's Achilles heel or Cranston's wrist. And it just it's a weak point that can be attacked. All right. We're actually recording a bunch of these in advance to give us a little time for some scheduling issues we're going to be facing in the coming weeks and months. So I'm not exactly sure what is going to happen next. I just know that there will be, as sure as the sun sets, another prestige film in your feed next week. I hope you enjoy it. And I hope you've enjoyed this talk about 10 years on with Drive. We'll see you on the next one. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.